This plan was carried out as had been arranged. I went to Geneva, where I was joined by my father. He had for some time been in the habit of visiting the place, without anyone molesting him, although the decree against him was still in force. But as he was esteemed for his courage and respected for his honesty, it was pretended that his little affair was forgotten, and the magistrates, busy with the grand scheme, which soon afterwards burst forth in all its glory, did not desire to irritate the middle classes prematurely by reminding them of their former partisanship at an inopportune moment. I was afraid of difficulties being raised in consequence of my change of religion, but found none. The laws of Geneva are in this respect not so severe as those of Bern, where anyone who changes his religion loses not only his status, but his property as well. My claims were not disputed, but the inheritance itself, for some reason or other which I do not know, was reduced to a very small sum. Although it was almost certain that my brother was dead, there was no legal proof of this. I had not sufficient title to claim his share, and I willingly left it to help to support my father, who, as long as he lived, enjoyed the use of it. As soon as the legal formalities were concluded, and I received my money, I laid out part of it in books, and flew to lay the rest at Mama's feet. During the journey my heart beat with joy, and at the moment when I placed this money in her hands, I was 1,000 times happier than when it was placed in mine. She received it with the simplicity of all beautiful souls, who, finding no difficulty in such actions themselves, are not astonished when they see them performed by others. The money was laid out almost entirely upon myself, with the same simplicity. It would have been employed in exactly the same manner if it had come from any other source. Meanwhile, my health was not completely re-established. On the contrary, I was visibly wasting away. I was as pale as a corpse and thin as a skeleton. The beating of my veins was terrible. The palpitations of my heart were more frequent. I continually suffered from shortness of breath, and my weakness at length became so great that I could scarcely move. I could not walk fast without a feeling of suffocation. I could not stoop without turning giddy. I could not lift the smallest weight. And I was forced to remain inactive, the greatest torment for a man as restless as I was. There is no doubt that my illness was, to a great extent, attributable to hysteria. This, which is the ailment of happy people, was mine. The tears which I often shed without any cause for weeping, my lively charm at the rustling of a leaf or the chirping of a bird, my changeable disposition amidst the calm of a most happy life, all these were indications of that weariness caused by happiness, which, so to speak, leads to an extravagant sensibility. We are so little formed for happiness in this world that of necessity the soul or the body must suffer when they do not suffer together, and a happy condition of the one nearly always injures the other. When I might have enjoyed life heartily, the decaying machinery of my body prevented me without anyone being able to localize the cause of the evil. Later, my body, in spite of my declining years and very real and painful sufferings, appears to have regained its strength in order to feel my sufferings more keenly. And while I am writing these words, weak and almost 60 years of age, overwhelmed by pains of every description, I feel that I possess more life and strength for suffering than I possessed for enjoyment in the flower of my age and in the bosom of the truest happiness. By way of reducing myself completely, after having read a little philosophy, I began the study of anatomy and took a survey of the number and working of the individual parts which composed my bodily machine. 20 times a day I was prepared to feel the whole out of gear. Far from being astonished at finding myself in a dying condition, I only felt surprised that I was still able to live, and I believed that every complaint of which I read the description was my own. I am convinced that if I had not been ill, this fatal study would have made me so. Finding in each complaint the symptoms of my own, I thought that I was suffering from all, and thereby contracted one, which was still more cruel than all the rest, and from which I thought I was free, an eager desire to be cured, which it is difficult for a man to escape when once he begins to read medical books. By dint of research, reflection, and comparison, I came to the conclusion that the foundation of my malady was a polypus of the heart, and Salomon himself seemed struck by this idea. These suppositions should reasonably have confirmed me in my previous resolutions, but this was not the case. I exerted all my mental powers to discover how polypus of the heart could be healed, resolved to undertake this marvellous cure. Anet, during a journey which he made to Montpellier to visit the botanical gardens and the demonstrator, Monsieur Sauvage, had been told that Monsieur Fils had cured such a polypus. Mama remembered this and mentioned it to me. This was enough to inspire me with a longing to go and consult Monsieur Fils. The hope of being cured restored my courage and gave me strength to undertake the journey. The money which I had brought from Geneva furnished the means, and Mama, far from attempting to dissuade me, encouraged me to go. Behold me, then, on my way to Montpellier. I had no need to go so far to find the physician I required. As riding fatigued me too much, I took a carriage at Grenoble. At Moirin, five or six other carriages arrived, one after the other, after my own. This time it was, in truth, the story of the sedan chairs. From Scarron's Roman Comique. Most of these carriages form part of the equipage of a newly wedded bride, whose name was Madame du Colombier. She was accompanied by another lady, Madame de Larnage, who was younger and not so good-looking, but equally amiable, who intended to proceed from Romain, where Madame du Colombier was stopping, to the town of Saint-Andiol, near the Pont Saint-Esprit. Considering my well-known shyness, it will not be imagined that I readily made the acquaintance of these elegant ladies and their suite, but at last, as I travelled by the same route, stopped at the same inns, and, under penalty of being considered a regular bore, was obliged to appear at the same table, it became impossible for me to avoid making the acquaintance. I did so, and even sooner than I could have wished, for all this bustle was ill-suited to a sick man, especially one of my temperament. But curiosity makes these roguish creatures so insinuating that, in order to make a man's acquaintance, they begin by turning his head. This is what happened to me. Madame du Colombier was too closely surrounded by young dandies to have time to make advances to me, and besides, it was not worthwhile, since we were soon to separate. But Madame de Larnage, who was not so beset by admirers, had to make provision for her journey. It was Madame de Larnage who undertook my conquest, and from that time it was goodbye to poor Jean-Jacques, or rather to my fever, hysteria, and polypus. Goodbye to everything, when in her company, with the exception of certain palpitations of the heart, which remained, and of which she showed no inclination to cure me. The bad state of my health was our first subject of conversation. They saw that I was ill, they knew that I was going to Montpellier, and my appearance and manners must have made it clear that I was no profligate, for it was evident, from what followed, that they did not suspect that I was going there in order to be cured of the effects of debauchery. Although ill health is no great recommendation amongst women, it made me interesting in the eyes of these ladies. In the morning they sent to know how I was, and invited me to take chocolate with them, and asked me how I'd passed the night. On one occasion, in accordance with my praiseworthy habit of speaking without thinking, I answered that I did not know. This answer made them think that I was mad. They examined me more closely, and this examination did me no harm. I once heard Madame du Colombier say to her friend, "He has no manners, but he is amiable." This word greatly encouraged me, and caused me to act up to it. As we became more intimate, I was obliged to speak about myself, to say who I was and where I came from. This caused me some embarrassment, for I clearly saw that the word convert would ruin me in polite society and amongst ladies of fashion. I do not know what curious whim prompted me to pass myself off as an Englishman. I gave myself out as a Jacobite. I called myself Dudding, and they called me Mr. Dudding. A confounded Marquis de Tarignan, who was with us, an invalid like myself, and old and ill-tempered into the bargain, took it into his head to enter into conversation with Mr. Dudding. He talked to me about King James, the Pretender, and the old court of Saint-Germain. I was on thorns. I knew nothing about them, except the little I had read in Count Hamilton and the newspapers. But I made such good use of my scanty knowledge that I got out of it pretty well. Luckily, no one thought of asking me about the English language, of which I did not understand a single word. We got on exceedingly well together and looked forward with regret to our separation. We travelled at a snail's pace by day. One Sunday we found ourselves at Saint-Marcellin. Madame de Larnage wanted to attend Mass, and I accompanied her, which nearly spoilt my game. I behaved during service as I had always been in the habit of doing. From my modest and reserved behaviour, she concluded that I was a devotee, which gave her the worst possible opinion of me, as she confessed to me 2 days later. It required great efforts of gallantry on my part to efface this unfavourable impression. Or rather, Madame de Larnage, like a woman of experience, not being easily discouraged, was willing to run the risk of making advances to see how I would extricate myself. She made them so freely, and in such a manner, that, since I thought nothing of my personal appearance, I believed she was laughing at me. In this ridiculous idea there was no kind of folly that I did not commit. I was worse than the Marquis du Legs. This is the character in Marivaux's comedy, who is in love for the first time, and being of an exceedingly timid disposition is afraid to make a declaration, while the character of the Countess is exactly the opposite. The plot turns on a legacy, Legs, hence the name. Madame de Larnage stood her ground, tried to tempt me so often, and spoke so tenderly to me, that a wiser man than myself would have found difficulty in taking it all seriously. The more she persisted, the more she confirmed me in my belief. And what tormented me still more was that I became seriously enamoured of her. I said, with a sigh, to myself and to her, "Ah, if all you say were only true, I should be the happiest of men." I believe that my raw simplicity only piqued her fancy, and that she was unwilling to acknowledge a defeat. We had left Madame de Colombier and her suite at Ormain. We continued our journey slowly and most agreeably, Madame de Larnage, the Marquis de Torignan, and myself. The Marquis, although an invalid and a grumbler, was a decent fellow, but was not best pleased at seeing other people enjoying themselves without being able to do so himself. Manger son pain à la fumée du rôti, literally, to eat bread when he could smell roast beef. Madame de Larnage took so little trouble to conceal her fancy for me that he perceived it sooner than I did myself, and his malicious sarcasms should at least have given me the confidence which I did not venture to draw from the lady's advances, had I not imagined, in a spirit of perversity, of which I alone was capable, that they had come to an understanding to amuse themselves at my expense. This foolish idea at last completely turned my head, and made me play the utter simpleton in a situation in which my heart, being really smitten, might have instructed me to act a far more distinguished part. I cannot understand how it was that Madame de Larnage was not disgusted with my sullenness, and did not dismiss me with utter contempt. But she was a clever woman, who understood the people she had to deal with, and saw clearly that there was more silliness than lukewarmness in my behaviour. She at last succeeded, with some difficulty, in making herself understood. We had reached Valence in time for dinner, and according to our praiseworthy custom, remained there for the rest of the day. We put up outside the town, at Saint-Jacques. I shall never forget this inn, or the room which Madame de Larnage occupied. After dinner she wanted to go for a walk. She knew that the Marquis was not fond of walking. It was a plan to secure for herself a tête-à-tête, which she had resolved to make the most of, for there was no more time to be lost, if any was to be left to make use of. We walked round the town, along the moats. I recommenced the long story of my complaints, to which she replied so tenderly, sometimes pressing my arm to her heart, that only stupidity like mine could have prevented me from being convinced that she spoke seriously. The unaccountable thing was that I myself was greatly affected. I have said that she was amiable. Love made her charming. It restored all the brightness of her early youth, and she managed her advances so cunningly that she would have seduced a man of the greatest experience. I was very ill at ease, and frequently on the point of taking liberties, but the fear of offending or displeasing her, and the still greater dread of being derided, laughed at, mocked, of providing an anecdote for the table, and being complimented upon my courage by the merciless Marquis, kept me back and made me feel irritated at my foolish bashfulness, and at my inability to overcome it, while I reproached myself with it. I was on the rack. I had already abandoned my timid language, the absurdity of which I felt now that I was so well on the road. My timid language, mes propos de Céladon, my Céladonic way of speaking. Céladon was one of the characters in the Astrée, a celebrated romance by Honoré d'Urfé, 1568 to 1625, and came to be used for a devoted but bashful lover. But as I did not know how to act or what to say, I held my tongue and looked sulky. In a word, I did everything that was calculated to bring upon me the treatment which I feared. Happily, Madame de Larnage was more humane. She abruptly interrupted the silence by putting her arm round my neck, while at the same time her mouth, pressed upon my own, spoke too clearly for me to have any further doubt. The crisis could not have occurred at a more happy moment. I became amiable. It was time. She had given me the confidence, the want of which has always prevented me from being natural. For once I was myself. Never have my eyes, my senses, my heart and my mouth spoken so well. Never have I repaired my errors so completely. And if this little conquest had cost Madame de Larnage some trouble, I had reason to believe that she did not regret it. If I were to live 100 years, I could never think of this charming woman without delight. I use the word charming because, although she was neither young nor beautiful, and yet neither old nor ugly, there was nothing in her face to prevent her intellect and grace from exercising their full effect. In complete contrast to other women, her least freshness was in her face, and I believe that the use of rouge had ruined it. She had reasons for her easy virtue. It was the best way in which she could assert all her charms. It was possible to look at her without loving her. It was impossible to possess her without adoring her. This seems to me to prove that she was not always so lavish of her favours as she was with me. Her advances to me had been too sudden and lively to be excusable, but her heart at least had as much to do with it as her senses, and during the brief and delicious period which I spent with her, I had reason to believe, from the forced moderation which she imposed upon me, that, although sensual and voluptuous, she thought more of my health than her own pleasure. The understanding between us did not escape the Marquis. He did not, however, leave off chaffing me, but on the contrary, treated me more than ever as a bashful lover, a martyr to his lady's cruelty. Not a word, not a smile, not a look escaped him, which could have made me suspect that he had found us out. And I should have believed that he had been deceived by us, had not Madame de Larnage, who was keener than I was, told me that this was not the case, but that he was a chivalrous man. And indeed no one could have shown more polite attention, nor behaved more courteously than he always did, even towards myself, with the exception of his raillery, especially after my success. He perhaps attributed the credit of it to me, and considered me not such a fool as I had appeared to be. He was mistaken, as has been seen, but no matter, I profited by his mistake. And it is true that, since I now had the laugh on my side, I endured his epigrams with good heart and grace, and sometimes retorted, even happily, proud to be able to exhibit, in the presence of Madame de Larnage, the wit with which she had credited me. I was no longer the same man. We were in a country and a season of good cheer, and thanks to the Marquis, we enjoyed it to the full. I could have dispensed with his extending his attentions even to our bedrooms, but he always sent his lackey to engage them in advance, and this rascal, either on his own responsibility or by the Marquis's instructions, always took a room for him next to Madame de Larnage, while I was poked away at the other end of the house. But this caused me little embarrassment, and only added piquancy to our rendezvous. This delightful life lasted 4 or 5 days, during which I was intoxicated with the sweetest pleasures. They were unadulterated and lively, without the least alloy of pain, the first and only pleasures of the kind that I have enjoyed. And I can only say that I owe it to Madame de Larnage that I shall not leave the world without having known the meaning of pleasure. If my feeling for her was not exactly love, it was at least so tender a return for the love which she showed for me. It was a sensuality so burning in its satisfaction, and an intimacy so sweet in its intercourse, that it had all the charm of passion without that delirium which turns the brain and spoils enjoyment. I have only felt true love once in my life, and it was not with her. Nor did I love her as I had loved, and still loved, Madame de Varennes. But for that very reason the possession of her afforded me 100 times greater enjoyment. With Mamma, my pleasure was always disturbed by a feeling of sadness, by a secret feeling of oppression at the heart, which I found difficult to overcome. Instead of congratulating myself upon possessing her, I reproached myself with degrading her. With Madame de Larnage, on the contrary, I was proud of my manhood and my happiness, and abandoned myself with confident joy to the satisfaction of my desires. I shared the impression which I produced upon hers. I was sufficiently master of myself to regard my triumph with as much self-complacency as pleasure, and to derive from it the means of redoubling it. I do not remember where the Marquis, who belonged to the district, left us, but we were alone when we reached Montélimar, where Madame de Larnage made her maid get into my carriage, while I travelled in her own. I can assure you that in this manner we did not find the journey tedious, and I should have found it difficult to describe the country through which we passed. She was detained at Montélimar 3 days on business, during which, however, she only left me for 1/4 hour to pay a visit, which brought her in return some importunate and pressing invitations, which she was by no means disposed to accept. She pleaded indisposition, which did not, however, prevent us from walking together alone every day in the most beautiful country, and under the most beautiful sky in the world. Oh, those 3 days! I have had reason to regret them sometimes. I have never enjoyed their like again. Travelling amours cannot last. We were obliged to separate, and I confess that it was time. Not that I was surfeited or anything like it. I became more attached to her every day, but in spite of her discretion I had little left except goodwill, and before we separated I wished to enjoy that little, which she submitted to by way of precaution against the young ladies of Montpellier. We beguiled our regrets by forming plans to meet again. It was decided that I should continue the treatment, which did me considerable good, and spend the winter at Saint-Andiol under her superintendence. I was to stay only 5 or 6 weeks at Montpellier, to allow her time to arrange the necessary preliminaries, to prevent scandal. She gave me full instructions about what it was necessary for me to know, what I was to say, and the manner in which I was to behave. Meanwhile, we were to write to each other. She spoke to me long and seriously about the care of my health, advised me to consult some clever physicians, to follow their instructions carefully, and took upon herself to make me carry out their directions, however strict they might be, as long as I was with her. I believe that she spoke sincerely, for she loved me. Of this she gave me numerous proofs, more reliable than her favours. From my style of travelling she judged that I was not rolling in money, and although she herself was by no means well off, she wanted to make me share the contents of her purse, which she had brought pretty well filled from Grenoble, and I had the greatest difficulty in making her accept my refusal. At last I left her, my heart full of her, and leaving, as I believe, a true attachment for myself in her own. I finished my journey, while going over it again in my memory from the beginning, and for the moment I was very well content to sit in a comfortable carriage and dream at my ease of the pleasures which I had enjoyed, and of those which were promised to me. I thought of nothing but Saint-Antioche, and the delightful life which awaited me there. I saw nothing but Madame de Larnage and her surroundings. The rest of the world was nothing to me. Even Mamma was forgotten. I employed myself in arranging in my head all the details into which Madame de Larnage had entered, in order to give me beforehand an idea of her house, her neighbourhood, her friends, and her manner of life. She had a daughter, of whom she had often spoken to me in terms of most lavish affection. This daughter was in her 16th year, lively, charming, and amiable. Madame de Larnage had promised me that I was sure to be a great favourite with her. I had not forgotten the promise, and I was very curious to see how Mademoiselle de Larnage would behave towards her mamma's good friend. Such were the subjects of my reveries from Pont-Saint-Esprit to Remoulin. I had been told to go and see the Pont du Gard, and did not fail to do so. It was the first Roman work that I had seen. I expected to see a monument worthy of the hands which had erected it. For once, and for the only time in my life, the reality surpassed the expectation. Only the Romans could have produced such an effect. The sight of this simple, yet noble, work produced a greater impression upon me as it was situated in the midst of a desert, where silence and solitude bring the object into greater prominence, and arouse a livelier feeling of admiration. For this pretended bridge was nothing but an aqueduct. One naturally asks what strength has transported these enormous stones so far from any quarry, and united the arms of so many thousands of men in a spot where not one of them dwells. I went through the three stories of this superb building, within which a feeling of respect almost prevented me from setting foot. The echo of my footsteps under these immense vaults made me imagine that I heard the sturdy voices of those who had built them. I felt myself lost like an insect in this immensity. I felt, in spite of my sense of littleness, as if my soul was somehow or other elevated, and I said to myself with a sigh, "Why was I not born a Roman?" I remained there several hours in rapturous contemplation. I returned, distracted and dreamy, and this dreaminess was not favourable to Madame de Larnage. She had been careful to warn me against the girls of Montpellier, but not against the Pont du Gard. One never thinks of everything. At Nîmes, I went to see the amphitheatre. It is a far more magnificent work than the Pont du Gard, but it made far less impression upon me. Either the latter had exhausted my powers of admiration, or the former, being situated in the midst of a town, was less calculated to arouse them. This vast and splendid circus is surrounded by ugly little houses, and the arena is filled with other houses, still smaller and uglier, so that the aspect of the whole produces a confused and incongruous effect, in which regret and indignation stifle pleasure and surprise. Since then I have seen the circus at Verona, which is far smaller and less imposing, but is kept and preserved with the greatest possible neatness and cleanliness, and for that very reason produced upon me a more forcible and agreeable impression. The French take care of nothing and have no respect for monuments. They are all eagerness to undertake anything, but do not know how to finish, or keep it in repair when it is finished. I was so changed, and my sensuality, which had been roused to activity, was awakened to such a degree that I remained for a whole day at the Pont de Lunel, in order to enjoy its good cheer with the other visitors. This inn, the most famous in Europe, at that time deserved its reputation. Its proprietors had known how to take advantage of its excellent position, in order to keep it abundantly supplied with choice provisions. It was really curious to find, in a lonely and isolated house in the middle of the country, a table furnished with salt and freshwater fish, excellent game, choice wines, served with the attention and civility which is only found in the houses of the great and wealthy, all for 35 sous a head. But the Pont de Lunel did not long remain on this footing, and by presuming too much on its reputation, at length lost it altogether. During my journey I had quite forgotten that I was ill. I remembered it when I arrived at Montpellier. My attacks of hysteria were certainly cured, but all my other ailments remained, and though familiarity made me less sensitive to them, they were enough to make anyone, who was suddenly attacked by them, fancy himself at death's door. In fact, they were more alarming than painful, and caused more suffering of the mind than of the body, the destruction of which they seemed to announce. Hence, while distracted by violent passions, I thought no more of the state of my health. But as my complaints were not imaginary, I became aware of them again as soon as I recovered my coolness. I then began to think seriously of Madame de Larnage's advice and the object of my journey. I consulted the most famous physicians, particularly Monsieur Fize, and by way of excessive precaution boarded with a doctor. He was an Irishman named Fitzmaurice, who took in a considerable number of medical students. And what made his house more comfortable for a resident patient was that he was satisfied with a moderate fee for board and charged his boarders nothing for medical attendance. He undertook to carry out Monsieur Fize's regulations and to look after my health. As far as diet was concerned, he acquitted himself admirably. None of his boarders suffered from indigestion, and although I am not very sensible to privations of this kind, the opportunities of drawing comparison were so near that I could not help sometimes thinking to myself that Monsieur de Torignon was a better purveyor than Monsieur Fitzmaurice. However, as we were not absolutely starved, and the young students were very cheerful, this way of living really did me good, and prevented me from falling into my former state of depression. I spent the morning in taking medicines, especially some waters, which I believe came from Valls, though I am not certain, and in writing to Madame de Larnage, for the correspondence continued, and Rousseau undertook to fetch his friend Dudding's letters. At noon I took a walk to La Canourge with one of our young messmates, all of whom were very good lads, after which we assembled for dinner. When this meal was over, most of us engaged in an important occupation until evening. We went a little way out of town to play two or three games of mall for our afternoon tea. Goûter, a light meal between dinner and supper. I did not play myself, as I possessed neither the requisite strength nor skill, but I betted on the result. In this manner, interested in my wager, I followed our players and their balls across rough and stony roads, and enjoyed agreeable and healthy exercise, which suited me admirably. We took our tea at an inn outside the city. I need not say that these meals were very lively, but I may add that there was nothing improper about them, although the landlord's daughters were very pretty. Monsieur Fitzmaurice, who was a great player himself, was our president, and I can declare that, in spite of the bad reputation of the students, I found more decency and propriety amongst these young men than it would have been easy to find amongst an equal number of grown-up men. They were noisy rather than licentious, merry rather than profligate, and I become so easily accustomed to any manner of life, when it is voluntary, that I could have desired nothing better than a continuance of it. Amongst the students were several Irish, from whom I tried to learn a few words of English, in anticipation of Saint-Andiol. For the time of my departure was close at hand. Madame de Larnage importuned me by every post, and I prepared to obey her. It was clear that my physicians, who did not understand my complaint at all, regarded it as existing only in my imagination, and under those circumstances treated me with their china root, their waters, and their whey. Physicians and philosophers, differing entirely from theologians, only admit that to be true which they are able to explain, and make their understanding the measure of what is possible. These gentlemen understood nothing about my complaint, therefore I was not ill at all. For, of course, doctors knew everything. I saw that they were only trying to humbug me and make me waste my money, and as I thought that their substitute at Saint-Andiol would do that just as well as they, but in a more agreeable manner, I resolved to give her the preference, and with this wise resolution I left Montpellier. I set out towards the end of November, after a stay of 6 weeks or 2 months in that city, where I left behind me a dozen louis d'or, without any benefit either to my health or understanding, with the exception of a course of anatomy which I commenced under Monsieur Fitzmaurice, and which I was obliged to give up, owing to the fearful stench of the bodies which were dissected, and which I found it impossible to endure. Feeling very ill at ease concerning the resolution that I'd taken, I began to reflect upon it as I continued my journey towards the Pont Saint-Esprit, which was the road to Chambéry as well as Saint-Andiol. The remembrance of Mamma and her letters, although she did not write to me so often as Madame de Larnage, again aroused in my heart the remorse which I had stifled during the first part of my journey, and which, on my return, became so keen that, counterbalancing the love of pleasure, it put me in a condition to listen to reason alone. In the first place, in the role of adventurer, which I was again going to play, I might be less fortunate than I had been on the previous occasion. It only needed, in the whole of Saint-Andiol, a single person who had been in England, or who was acquainted with the English manners or language, to expose me. Madame de Larnage's family might take a dislike to me and treat me with discourtesy. Her daughter, of whom, in spite of myself, I thought more than I ought to have done, also caused me considerable uneasiness. I trembled at the idea of falling in love with her, and this very apprehension half finished the business. Was I, by way of repaying the mother's kindness, to attempt to lead the daughter astray, to enter upon a most detestable connection, to bring dissension, dishonour, scandal, even hell itself into her house? This idea horrified me. I firmly resolved to resist and defeat myself, if this wretched inclination made itself felt. But why expose myself to such a struggle? What a miserable state of things would it be to live with the mother, of whom I was tired, and to be burning with love for the daughter, without daring to disclose the state of my feelings? What necessity was there deliberately to seek such a position, to expose myself to misfortunes, affronts, and remorse, for the sake of pleasures, the greater charm of which I had exhausted in advance? For it is certain that my fancy had lost its early vivacity. The taste for pleasure was still there, but not passion. With these thoughts were mingled reflections upon my situation and my duty, and thoughts of that good and generous mamma, whose debts, already heavy, were increased by my foolish expenditure, who drained her purse for my sake, and whom I was so unworthily deceiving. This reproach became so lively that it finally turned the scale. When I'd nearly reached the Pont Saint-Esprit, I resolved to hasten past Saint-Andiol without stopping. I carried out this resolution courageously, with a few sighs, I confess, but also with the inward satisfaction that, for the first time in my life, I could say to myself, I have a right to think well of myself. I know how to prefer my duty to my pleasure. This was the first real advantage for which I had to thank my studies. They had taught me to reflect and compare. After the virtuous principles which I had so recently adopted, after the rules of wisdom and virtue which I had drawn up for myself, and which I had felt such pride in following, a feeling of shame at being so little consistent with myself, of giving the lie to my own maxims so soon and so emphatically, gained the victory over pleasure. Perhaps pride has as much to do with my resolution as virtue, but if this pride is not virtue itself, its effects are so similar that it is excusable to confound them. One of the good results of virtuous actions is that they elevate the soul and incline it to attempt something even better, for so great is human weakness that we must reckon amongst virtuous actions abstention from the evil which we are tempted to commit. As soon as I had taken my resolution, I became another man, or rather, I became the man I had formerly been, whom the intoxication of the moment had caused to disappear. Full of good sentiments and good resolutions, I continued my journey with the intention of expiating my error, thinking only of regulating my future conduct by the laws of virtue, of devoting myself unreservedly to the service of the best of mothers, of vowing to her a loyalty equal to my attachment, and of listening to no other call but that of my duties. Alas, the sincerity of my return to virtue appeared to promise a different destiny. But my own was already written and begun, and at the moment when my heart, full of love for all that was good and honourable, saw nothing but innocence and happiness before it, I was approaching the fatal moment which was destined to drag behind it the long chain of my misfortunes. My impatience to reach home made me travel faster than I had intended. I had sent a letter to Mamma from Valence to inform her of the day and hour of my arrival. As I was half a day in advance, I spent that time at Chaperillon, in order to arrive exactly at the moment I had fixed. I wanted to enjoy to the full the pleasure of seeing her again. I preferred to put it off a little, in order to add to it the pleasure of being expected. This precaution had always proved successful. I had always found my arrival celebrated by a kind of little holiday. I expected as much on this occasion, and these attentions, which I felt so much, were worth the trouble of procuring. I arrived, then, punctual, to the moment. When I was still some distance off, I looked ahead in the hope of seeing her on the road. My heart beat more violently the nearer I approached. I arrived out of breath, for I'd left my carriage in town. I saw no one in the court, at the door, or at the window. I began to feel uneasy and afraid that some accident had happened. I entered. Everything was quiet. Some workmen were eating in the kitchen. There were no signs that I was expected. The maid appeared surprised to see me. She knew nothing about my coming. I went upstairs. At last I saw her, my dear Mamma, whom I loved so tenderly, so deeply and so purely. I ran up to her and threw myself at her feet. "Ah," said she, embracing me, "you are back again then, little one. Have you had a pleasant journey? How are you?" This reception somewhat surprised me. I asked her whether she'd received my letter. She answered, "Yes." "I should not have thought so," I said. And the explanation ended there. A young man was with her. I remembered having seen him in the house before I left, but now he seemed established there, as in fact he was. In a word, I found my place filled. This young man belonged to the Vaud country. His father, named Witzenried, was keeper, or as he called himself, captain of the castle of Chillon. The son was a journeyman wig-maker, and was travelling the country in pursuit of his calling, when he first presented himself to Madame de Warens, who received him kindly, as she received all travellers, especially those from her own country. He was tall, fair-haired, insipid, tolerably well set up, with a face as dull as his intellect, and spoke like a beau Léandre, mingling all the airs and tastes of his calling with the long story of his conquests, and, according to his own account, mentioning only half the marchionesses with whom he had slept, and boasting that he had never dressed a pretty woman's head without decorating the husband as well. A beau Léandre was one of the stock characters of Italian comedy, a fop who takes great pride in his personal appearance and is fond of displaying his ribbons and lace. Vain, foolish, ignorant, and insolent, he was in other respects the best fellow in the world. Such was the substitute who replaced me during my absence, and the companion who was offered to me after my return. If souls, when freed from their earthly bonds, still look down from the bosom of the eternal light upon that which takes place upon this earth, pardon me, dear and honoured shade, if I show no more favour to your faults than my own, but unveil both equally before the reader's eyes. I must and will be as true for you as for myself. You will always have much less to lose than I. Ah, how your amiable and gentle character, your inexhaustible goodness of heart, your frankness, and all your admirable qualities atone for your weaknesses, if simple errors of judgment deserve that name. You erred, but you were free from vice. Your conduct was blameworthy, but your heart was always pure. The newcomer had shown himself zealous, diligent, and careful in carrying out her numerous little commissions, and had appointed himself foreman of her labourers. As noisy as I was quiet, he was seen and heard everywhere at once, at the plough, in the hayloft, in the woodhouse, in the stable, in the farmyard. Gardening was the only thing he neglected, because the work was too quiet and afforded no opportunity for making a noise. His great delight was to load and drive a wagon, to saw or chop wood. He was always to be seen with an axe or pick in his hand, running, hustling, and shouting with all his might. I do not know how many men's work he did, but he made noise enough for 10 or 12. All this noise and bustle imposed on my poor mamma. She thought that in this young man she had found a treasure to assist her in business matters. In order to attach him to her, she employed all the means she thought likely to produce this result, not forgetting that on which she placed most reliance. The reader must have gained some knowledge of my heart and of its truest and most constant feelings, especially those which brought me back to her at this moment. What a sudden and complete upset of my whole being! To judge of it, let the reader put himself in my place. I saw all the happy future which I had depicted to myself vanish in a moment. All the dreams of happiness which I had so fondly cherished disappeared. And I, who from my youth had never considered my existence except in connection with hers, for the first time found myself alone. This moment was frightful. Those which followed were all gloomy. I was still young, but the pleasant feeling of enjoyment and hope which animates youth deserted me forever. From that time my sensible being was half dead. I saw nothing before me but the melancholy remains of an insipid life. And if now and again an image of happiness floated lightly across my desires, this happiness was no longer that which was peculiarly my own. I felt that, even if I succeeded in obtaining it, I should still not be really happy. I was so simple, and my confidence was so great, that, in spite of the newcomer's familiar tone, which I looked upon as one of the results of Mamma's easy-going disposition, which attracted everyone towards her, I should never have suspected the real reason of it, unless she had told me herself. But she hastened to make this avowal with a frankness which might well have increased my rage if my heart had been capable of it. She herself considered it quite a simple matter, reproached me with my carelessness in the house, and appealed to my frequent absences, as if her temperament had been such that it required the void to be filled as quickly as possible. "Ah, Mamma," I said to her, with a heart wrung with grief, "what do you dare to tell me? What a reward for such devotion as mine! Have you so often saved my life, only in order to deprive me of that which made it dear to me? It will kill me, but you will regret my loss." She replied, with a calmness calculated to drive me mad, that I was a child, that people did not die of such things, that I should lose nothing, that we should be equally good friends, equally intimate in all respects, and that her tender attachment to me could neither diminish nor end, except with her own life. In short, she gave me to understand that all my privileges would remain the same, and that, while sharing them with another, I should not find them in any way curtailed. Never did the purity, truth, and strength of my attachment for her, never did the sincerity and uprightness of my soul make itself more plainly felt than at that moment. I threw myself at her feet, and shedding floods of tears, clasped her knees. "No, Mamma," I exclaimed, half distracted, "I love you too deeply to degrade you. The possession of you is too precious for me to be able to share it with another. The regrets which I felt when you first bestowed yourself upon me have increased with my affection. I cannot retain possession of you at the same price. I shall always worship you, remain worthy of it. I have still greater need to respect than to possess you. I resign you to yourself. To the union of our hearts I sacrifice all my pleasures. I would rather die 1,000 times than seek an enjoyment which degrades one whom I love." I remained true to this resolution with a steadfastness worthy, I venture to say, of the feeling which had produced it. From that moment I only regarded this dear Mamma with the eyes of a real son, and I must observe that, although my resolution did not meet with her private approbation, as I perceived only too clearly, she never attempted to make me abandon it, either by insinuating proposals, caresses, or any of those clever allurements which women so well know how to make use of without committing themselves, and which are rarely unsuccessful. Compelled to seek for myself a lot independent of her, and unable even to think of one, I soon fell into the other extreme, and sought it entirely in her. There I sought it so completely that I almost succeeded in forgetting myself. The ardent desire to see her happy at whatever cost absorbed all my affections. It was useless for her to separate her happiness from mine. I looked upon it as my own in spite of her. Thus, together with my misfortunes, those virtues began to develop, the seeds of which were sown at the bottom of my heart, which had been cultivated by study, and only waited for the leaven of adversity in order to bear fruit. The first result of this disinterestedness was the removal from my heart of all feeling of hatred and envy against him who had supplanted me. On the contrary, I desired, in all sincerity, to become intimate with this young man, to form his character, to educate him, to make him sensible of his happiness, to make him worthy of it, if possible, and, in a word, to do for him all that Aeneas had formerly done for me in similar circumstances. But our dispositions were not alike. Although gentler and better informed than Aeneas, I possessed neither his coolness nor firmness, nor that force of character which inspires respect, and which would have been necessary to ensure success. Still less did I find in this young man the qualities which Aeneas had found in me: docility, attachment, gratitude, and above all the consciousness that I needed his attention, and the eager desire of profiting by it. All these qualities were wanting. He whom I wanted to educate considered me as nothing more than a tiresome pedant, who could do nothing else but chatter. On the other hand, he admired himself as a person of importance in the house, and estimating the services he thought he rendered by the noise he made about them, he looked upon his axes and picks as infinitely more useful than all my old books. In a certain sense he was right, but starting from that he gave himself airs enough to make anyone die with laughter. With the peasants he attempted to play the country gentleman. He soon treated me in the same way, and even Mama herself. As the name Witzenried did not appear sufficiently distinguished, he abandoned it for that of Monsieur de Coty, by which name he was afterwards known at Chambéry, and in Maurienne, where he married. In a word, this illustrious person soon became everything in the house, and I myself nothing. If I had the misfortune to displease him, it was Mama, not I, whom he scolded. For this reason, the fear of exposing her to his brutal behaviour rendered me subservient to all his wishes. And, whenever he chopped wood, an occupation of which he was inordinately proud, I was obliged to stand by, an idle spectator and quiet admirer of his prowess. His disposition was not, however, altogether bad. He loved Mama because no one could help loving her. He showed no aversion even for me, and in his calmer moments he sometimes listened to us quietly enough and frankly owned that he was only a fool, and immediately afterwards proceeded to commit fresh follies. In addition to this, his understanding was so limited, and his tastes so low, that it was difficult to reason and almost impossible to feel at ease with him. Not content with the possession of a most charming woman, he added, by way of seasoning, that of an old, red-haired, toothless waiting-woman, whose disgusting services Mama had the patience to endure, although it quite upset her. I observed this new intrigue and was beside myself with indignation, but at the same time I perceived something else, which affected me still more deeply, and dispirited me more than anything else which had as yet occurred. This was a growing coldness in Mama's behaviour towards me. The privation which I had imposed upon myself, and of which she had pretended to approve, is one of those things which women never pardon, however they pretend to take it, not so much for the sake of that of which they are themselves deprived, as by reason of the feeling of indifference which they consider it implies. Take the most sensible, the most philosophical, the least sensual woman. The most unpardonable crime that a man, for whom in other respects she cares nothing, can be guilty of towards her, is not to enjoy her favours when he has the chance of doing so. There can be no exception to this rule, since a sympathy, at once so natural and so deep, was impaired in her in consequence of an abstinence, the only motives of which were virtue, attachment, and esteem. From that moment I no longer found in her that intimacy of hearts which had always afforded the sweetest enjoyment to my own. She no longer unbosomed herself to me, except when she had occasion to complain of the newcomer. When they were on good terms, I was rarely admitted to her confidence. At length, by degrees, she became entirely estranged from me. She still seemed pleased to see me, but no longer found my company indispensable. Even had I passed whole days without seeing her, she would not have noticed it. Insensibly, I felt myself isolated and alone in that house of which I had formerly been the soul, and in which I led, so to speak, a double life. I gradually accustomed myself to disregard all that took place in it, and even kept aloof from those who dwelt in it. In order to spare myself considerable torment, I shut myself up with my books, or wept and sighed to my heart's content in the midst of the woods. This life soon became unendurable. I felt that the personal presence of a woman who was so dear to me, while I was estranged from her heart, only aggravated my sorrow, and that I should feel the separation from her less cruelly if I no longer saw her. I therefore resolved to leave the house. I told her so, and far from offering any opposition, she approved of it. She had a friend at Grenoble, named Madame des Bons, whose husband was a friend of Monsieur de Mably, the Grand Prévôt of Lyon. Monsieur des Bons suggested to me that I should undertake the education of Monsieur de Mably's children. I accepted the post and set out for Lyon, without causing, almost without feeling, the slightest regret at a separation, the mere idea of which would formerly have caused us both the most deadly anguish. I possessed almost sufficient knowledge for a tutor, and believed that I had the necessary qualifications. During the year which I spent at Monsieur de Mably's, I had ample time to undeceive myself. My naturally gentle disposition, which would have made me well adapted for this profession, had not a violent temper been mingled with it. As long as all went well, and I saw that my trouble and attention, of which I was not sparing, were successful, I was an angel. But when things went wrong, I was a devil. When my pupils did not understand me, I raved like a madman. When they showed signs of insubordination, I could have killed them, which was not the way to make them either learned or well-behaved. They were two in number, of very different dispositions. One, between 8 and 9 years old, named Sainte-Marie, had a pretty face, was fairly intelligent, lively, giddy, playful, and mischievous. But his mischief was always good-humoured. The younger, Condillac, who seemed almost stupid, was idle and lazy, as obstinate as a mule, and incapable of learning anything. It may be imagined that, between the two, I had my work cut out. With the aid of patience and coolness, I might, perhaps, have succeeded. But as I possessed neither, I made no progress, and my pupils turned out very badly. I did not lack assiduity, but I wanted evenness of temper, and above all, tact. I only knew three means to employ, which are always useless and frequently ruinous to children: sentiment, argument, anger. At one time, with Saint-Marie, I was moved to tears, and attempted to arouse similar emotions in him, as if a child could have been capable of genuine feeling. At another time I exhausted myself in arguing with him, as if he'd been able to understand me. And, as he sometimes made use of very subtle arguments, I seriously thought that he must be intelligent, because he knew how to argue. The little Condillac was still more troublesome, since he understood nothing, never made an answer, and was never affected by anything. His obstinacy was immovable, and he never enjoyed anything more than the triumph of putting me in a rage. Then, indeed, he was the wise man, and I was the child. I recognized all my faults, and was conscious of them. I studied my pupils' characters and fathomed them successfully. And I do not believe that I was ever once taken in by their artifices. But what advantage was it to me to see the evil, if I did not know how to apply the remedy? Although I saw through everything, I prevented nothing, and succeeded in nothing, and everything that I did was exactly what I ought not to have done. I was hardly more successful in regard to myself than my pupils. Madame d'Aibon had recommended me to Madame de Mably, and had requested her to form my manners and to give me the tone of society. She took some pains about it, and wanted to teach me how to do the honours of her house. But I showed myself so awkward, I was so bashful and so stupid, that she became discouraged and gave me up. This, however, did not prevent me falling in love with her, after my usual manner. I managed to make her perceive it, but I never dared to declare my passion. She was never disposed to make advances, and all my ogling glances and sighs were in vain, so that I soon wearied of them, seeing they led to nothing. While with Mama, I had completely lost my inclination for petty thefts, because, since everything was mine, I had nothing to steal. Besides, the lofty principles which I'd laid down for myself ought to have made me, for the future, superior to such meannesses, and certainly they have usually done so. But this was not so much the result of my